This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So I'm glad everyone could come out today on this beautiful spring day to be with us who have been sitting some this week in honor to celebrate Buddha's birthday. It's a sesshin we do in the spring every year, Tanjoe, the samadhi and gathering. So it's been a joyous week, and that's been one of our themes, joy. We've also touched on many others, grief and the past, and many stories. Been a really wonderful group. We've had the opportunity to hike up, thanks to Doug, who built into our schedule sunset on the ridge. So we sat Zazen on the ridge. Very wonderful. I hope that could continue next year when this goes again. So we talked a little bit about birthdays. For one thing, and I'd like to talk a little more about birthdays, particularly Buddha's birthday, since this is the day. And we do have a special celebration at 2 o'clock. That's a little ritual celebration that's done in Soto Zen tradition to honor the birth of Buddha, as we honor all births, really. Births are joyous occasions. And so it's only fitting, since we're practicing in this way and have been given so many gifts by Shakyamuni Buddha, that we give maybe a little gift back, a little gift of tea and cake and a little ritual. So the stories of Buddha's birth have many forms. But they all have one thing in common, a mother. And we share that with Buddha, as do all other humans. And many other creatures actually are born of mothers. So we, even now, we have the capability to modify, this is very new technology, or relatively new, to modify our genes in embryos. But that embryo must be planted in a woman that can give birth to, in order to bring a human being into this world. So mothers literally embody us, every one of us, alive now and in the past, including Shakyamuni Buddha. And that is part of our human nature, our animal nature, and our Buddha nature, which isn't different from our human nature and our animal nature. We have the capacity to awaken from any delusions we have, angers, greeds. We have that capability. As Shakyamuni Buddha realized, that was one of the gifts he gave us. And so in this lineage, particularly Mahayana, Zen, and Chan, acknowledge this by recognizing Prajna Paramita, the mother of all Buddhas. And we chant that at almost every sesshin, not everyone, but we chant the Prajna Paramita Sutra. It's a complex word, like many historical terms. It has a lot of meanings. But in the sutra chant, it's, you know, we chant the very short version, wisdom beyond wisdom, or in the language of the chant we did today, boundless a wisdom. It also encompasses form and emptiness and refuge, to just name a few. But the mother of all Buddhas, Prajna Paramita, is also present in the Prajna Paramita chant that we do. It's embedded in it because it comes from a much larger body of sutras and called the Prajnaparamita, the 10,000 verses. It's a very large body of sutras, and they all acknowledge the mother of all Buddhas is Prajnaparamita. And those sutras actually are still being uncovered. They're not all known yet. Archaeologists, historians, religious historians find these still to this day. So this mother is invoked by phrases such as limitless, selfless love, and similar to words that we chant in the Metta Sutta. You know, we chant that we will cherish all beings like a mother does her only child, or a father. So these figures that have been born into the world of mothers and have understood something about what it is to be a human being and something about what it is to be, what our aspirations are and what our possibilities are, like Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, our historical Buddha, like Christ. So these sorts of people naturally make an impression on those around them, and they accumulate stories around them. And when the stories become part of the culture, then they become mythological. So there are many myths about many historical figures like this, including Shakyamuni Buddha. People use their imaginations and their skills to tell stories. We like to kind of use those faculties we have to remember important things. So there are many stories in the Mahayana, that many beautiful sutras that have a lot of these wonderful mythological settings and characters and situations with many Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. The Avatamsaka Sutra and the Lotus Sutra for just a couple. So about Shakyamuni Buddha, there's a common mythological story from early times. It's not known exactly when, according to the little that I read about it. But the story, the common one, goes that he was born from his mother's side, fully formed as a small child, who stepped out of his mother's side, put his feet on the ground, and looked around and looked up and said, "I alone am the world honored one." Another piece of the story is that it was spring and flowers were in bloom, and he was attended by elephants at his birth. And then his mother died after he was born. So the more prosaic account that's according to what I understand, that's accepted by most historians of early Buddhism, is that Buddha's mother, Maya, left the compound where she was living with his father, who was a warrior prince, Suddhodana, and she traveled back to her family to give birth, which was very common in those days. And she was accompanied by her sister, Pajapati, who was later the first woman disciple of Buddha's, whose name we chant today, Maha Pajapati. So there were some attendants, and perhaps on elephants, but most likely on horses, because that's what was common in that time, in that era of those warrior princes were horsemen. And the birth came before the party could reach the family compound of Maya's. So Shakyamuni Buddha was born either in a grove of trees or a garden, something like that. So So at this point, the historians are speculative, but some say that Maya lived a few days and nursed the baby Siddhartha. She may have even reached her parental home, and likely asked her mother and sister to raise the baby because she was not well and she didn't survive long. Raise the baby as if it's your own child. So this is speculative by some historians that I've read. There's a contemporary Buddhist teacher, Anne Cushman, who wrote in this era, in the early 2000s, a wonderful imaginative story of Buddha's birth from her own experience as a mother. It's a very real and graphic retelling of the physical and emotional journey that mothers take when they give birth. It's an embodiment story, as we are embodied as Buddhas and as humans. But this embodiment story that Anne writes has blood, amniotic fluids, sweat, tears, cries, shrieks, and the baby Buddha, who was called Siddhartha, the Prince Siddhartha, was most likely his sister, who was most likely a midwife. There's it's a very early profession historically, being a midwife, knew something of how to deliver a baby who wasn't coming out right. And so as Anne imagines this story, Pajapati said, the baby isn't coming out. So it's going to die if unless we get it out. And Maya said, well, then take it out. Take the baby out. Let the baby be born. And Pajapati said, well, you may die. And she said, that's all right. The baby needs to be born. And then she imagines at the end of her story, that Anne Cushman's story, that the words, the world honored ones, are not what a full-formed child at the moment of birth said, but that Maya said, looking at her child, you are my world honored one. So the Buddha was born like we all are born, a human being with a body, a mind, and a heart. And he took his first breath like we take our first breath. He also died with the last breath, like we will die with our last breath. And he was born with all the various senses that we chant in the Heart Sutra, that there are none of those, and yet there are. And he was born with the faculty of consciousness. And he grew up as an ordinary person in a sheltered life as a prince, of course, but until he had some insight into the human condition of greed, hatred, delusion, suffering. And then he had this insight and realization that there was another kind of awareness one could have. And from then on, he dedicated his life to exploring this condition. And that's what we still practice today. So he persevered, and going through many trials and trying to go to the way of mortification and not eating and thinking he would become pure and would transcend and would have some super realization, and that he would be free of the suffering that he felt for himself and others, that he would somehow get beyond that. But that didn't work for him. And he realized, like, I'm not gonna make it if I just keep doing this. So he realized that he just couldn't go on like that. So he, one story, which is also, there's some mythological elements to this other story of how Buddha came back from that. And he sat under a tree, rested his weary body under a tree, his really almost dying body from starvation under a tree. And he was nurtured back to health by a woman of the field, a young woman, Sujata, who was a cowherd. And she happened to notice as she was going on her rounds that there was this man who was sitting there and almost who needed help. And so she nursed him with milk, which she had, and rice gruel. And that too could be considered a myth. Historians think it likely something, there was a Sujata of some importance in Buddha's life, because that's one of the early disciples of Buddha too, Sujata. So in bringing this back to the Zen tradition, the sixth ancestor, Huineng, says, "For an ordinary person is Buddha, and defilements are awakening. A foolish passing thought makes one an ordinary person. And a passing thought awakened makes one a Buddha, and a passing thought that clings to sense objects is a defilement, while a second thought that sees into that frees one from that attachment, and that's awakening." So what we are here exploring, I think all of us, why we come here, is how do we open to that whole nature that all of our ancestors in these traditions of Buddhism and other traditions as well, but in Buddhism, it's very specific. How do we open to that? Through our own embodiment, through being with and in our bodies, and understanding what arises as it arises. And thoughts are part of embodiment. They just happen naturally. We couldn't exist without our thoughts and thinking. But remembering, we have the awareness, the awakening awareness beyond ordinary consciousness that allows us to distinguish foolish thoughts and awakening thoughts. So, specifically here in Soto Zen, in this temple and others throughout the world, we just sit down. We have ancestors, many ancestors, like from the first ancestor Bodhidharma in this tradition, Zen, to Dogen, and then others that we chanted today, Kogen Shinrin, who said, we just sit down. This is the gateway. Simply sitting is the gateway to our total being. And it's so simple, we don't believe it in a way when we first begin it. It's just so simple that we just go, what? Because we're so used to dividing things and trying to figure things out and putting things together. But it's really that simple. So, as they say, it's simple but not easy, because keeping with that awakening awareness is, it takes some practice, and that's why we keep practicing. And we have lots of stories. We heard stories yesterday from Eric, who's Eric Remington, who was a longtime Cogentino student and was here at the beginning of the founding of this fairy temple, along with others, and of what, you know, what Coven told him. It was just simple, just sit, pure practice, and don't get distracted. And there are so many stories of nuns and monks and lay people who kept waking up to the wholeness of embodiment, really in their bodies. You know, they practice sitting and then they go out and live in the world. Because even monks and nuns live in the world of the monastery and the nunnery, and that's human relations and that's work. And in the old days, feeding oneself, cultivating the gardens, doing everything. So, and it keeps on going on throughout life. The old nun who sees the clouds, the sun break through at dawn and wakes again. Oh, this. And the young nun who's drawing water from the well and feels in her core and the strength of her arms. Oh, I'm awake. Those moments of awakened embodiment. Doug brought in one of the stories. It's a long, one piece of the stories he brought in was of the monk who hoes the field and awakes from the sound of his hoe striking a rock. So it's through the hearing door. So we say no hearing, but any of the sense doors is an opening to awakening. Or the layman who dreams of the tempter Mara having a nightmare and awakes from knowing that's a dream. And what we call reality is a kind of, can be an illusion, it can be a dream. We can live in that dream world even when we're awake, but not this awakening to our whole nature. So waking in every moment, that's always a possibility for us. And that's all I brought today. So I'm very curious and hope that you bring something too about anything, about Buddha's birthday or the beautiful spring or anything that's come up for you. Thank you for your attention. And thank you for your attention, all of those out in Zoom land. I see many familiar faces, and John from Minnesota, who has sat with us on Zoom this whole retreat. That's been wonderful. There's Randy and Susan and Karen and Nico and Shinsen and Kristen, Jennifer, Daryl. So anyone online or in the room. Craig.
But in depth of that story on Buddha's birthday, no better storyteller than Herman Hesse. I really did enjoy your reading very much. But I was reminded of Thich Nhat Hanh when you talked about thoughts that arise that are foolish versus those that are awakening. I think Thich Nhat Hanh phrases that kind of like watering the bad seeds versus watering the good seeds. And I do find that instruction helpful. So I really like being reminded of it. I like, too, that you talked about Coben's instruction to Eric on sitting. It's so that sitting is so simple. And I have to admit, I have to contrast that with all the jabbering I just did in instructing on meditation prior to coming in. Can you talk a little bit about entering the path or finding the path again through the help of another and their jabbering versus the introduction of the path or reintegration on the path without the jabbering path?
Well, I could say a few words, but mostly from my teacher, what I remember from my teacher, Angie, who was one of the founders of this very center with Coben and Eric and others. But first, I want to thank you for bringing in Thich Nhat Hanh's words. He has a real gift for the short and apt metaphor. but that is in the original suttas too, but it's kind of more drawn out. The Pali, the discourses are rather lengthy, but they do get repeated a lot. So that's why they're lengthy. But that idea of water the good seeds and the bad seeds, but that's beautiful. Just when you see a thought arise and you know with your true nature, which is also a phrase that Thich Nhat Hanh uses a lot, that it doesn't feel good to be there, to go there. You can just notice that. So don't let that one go. So one thing Coben Chino says, thoughts are natural, but just don't invite them in for tea. Just let them flow on through. That's another thing. And as far as, I do feel that one of the beauties of Soto Zen, particularly, is that it is so simple, because when we do overlay a lot of instructions and which you call jabbering, but really they were instructions. You were doing your best to orient, and we all, so it's like finding the balance. We all need to be, when we come into something completely new, some people are more just go for it, dive in, and other people are more like, I just want to know a little bit more about it. So it's finding that balance of being as simple as we can. And the focus in Soto Zen is embodiment. It is the posture. It is Shikin Taza. So just sitting with your hips angled properly forward, so these cushions allow you to do that, or however you find a way to do that. And if you need to sit in a chair, that's fine too. Just get your knees below your, angling down, and your feet on the floor, and then your spine upright with the natural curve, and your chin, as Eric put it, it's like classic Soto Zen, and your chin a little bit down. Otherwise, you're like, and this is a real tendency in people, because we drive, we watch computers, we noise like chicken necks, like always going up and out, but really down a little bit. And then keeping your shoulders kind of aligned and even and more or less with your ears, and keeping a strong back but an open heart. So also a balance. So a kind of an openness in the front and a steadiness in the back. And of course, during a sitting, the body wants to move. So we might have to make little adjustments. And the longer we sit, sometimes getting into a deep place, you won't, but it's all right to make the adjustments, just notice them, be aware that this is, it's actually can be a help to the body. It's an awakened thought. Just be more at ease in the body. Dogen talks about that, the ease and joy of Zazen. It's beautiful. So I hope that addressed some. Thank you, Craig, for the question and for the comment. Water, the good seeds, not the bad seeds. Karen.
From one of those comments about the thoughts that come to our mind when we are sitting, or in general when we're not sitting. And so, and then our practice is about looking at thoughts. And so like this week, I was reading a book by this teacher from India called Ramana Maharishi. And so he had this teaching about this method of inquiry, which is similar to Buddha's method, but that method is just about asking, who am I, and just having that asking that question very honestly, like, who am I? So I was just practicing that during this week, and then I remember like one of the talks at Jukoji or one of the teachings by one of the Zen masters about thoughts, that you don't know where thoughts come from and where is the place where thoughts come from. If you look at that, you don't you can't find a place where they come from. And so as I was doing this exercise, because when a thought would come, I would realize that it was something that I had seen, something that had happened to me, something that I was imagining in the future. It was always related to like what I had seen or felt or heard or one of my experiences. But then I fell into a place where it seemed like it was not coming from what I had seen or what I had felt. And then I had this like feeling of like this vast feeling. And then I had this thought coming to my mind, which was from another talk at Jikoji, which was about like trusting emergence and trusting something inside of you, like or intuition. And so I just wanted to share that because this one more thing that I want to share is I was also reading this book by this famous psychologist, Carl Gustav Jung, and he said intuition is something that we don't understand because it comes from the subconscious. So it's as if your subconscious is communicating to your conscious mind. It could be even beyond that. So just on thoughts, and I wanted to share that.
Thank you. That's very, very fine practice, I think. Always asking the question. And there's Zen practice also, Korean Zen, has a variation of that. Not who am I? Always a good question to ask, but what is this? What is this? Or what is this? What is this thought? Thank you.
Jess has a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Beautiful talk. I got a lot out of it. Thank you so much.
As you know, I'm new to Buddhism. Yeah. I might be one of those folks who's diving right in, but also has read a lot before coming here on my own, got a lot of study. And one thing that I find I struggle with again and again is contradictions that I keep on almost looking for, finding, where I'll hear one thing and then I'll be like, that contradicts with this other thing I read somewhere else. Or I'm like constantly trying to figure out, you know, which one is the truth. And maybe it is just, what is the truth to me? Like, does anyone know the real truth? I don't know, but it's as a new like student, I'm finding that I'm going in circles a little bit around the contradictions that I keep on discovering as I'm learning from masters and people who obviously know what they're talking about in some way and have been, you know, Buddhists for decades and decades and decades. So I'm trying to get as much out of what they're telling me as I just mean, you know, impossible or possible to do. I'd love to hear about your advice for someone in my position on how to handle that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jess. Yes. Jess just dove right in here. Beautiful. Well, advice is something I don't give, or I have a practice of trying not to give advice. but I can tell you my experience as someone who has somewhat of a sympathetic nature, perhaps, like being a kind of a cast of mind that's always looking and seeking and figuring things out, et cetera. And the best, and this was advice in a way, or just maybe a suggestion that I heard from one of my very first Buddhist teachers. And he said, or no, it wasn't, it was like maybe the second, but anyway, it doesn't matter. He said, just don't read anything. And I took that as a practice, and I did not read anything about Buddhism for a year and a half. And it was the practice, it was. And I had read a little bit before, and, you know, but, that helped me see, just do the practice, which wasn't shikantaza, but it was, you know, in the insight tradition, practices also are looking at the same thing. All these practices come from the early tradition, and they get modified, and they get according to the conditions of the time and place, and that people do have further insights in a way, or further methods, like the Indian teacher Karan talked about, you know, like there's different ways to approach this. So it's more like a kaleidoscope or something. There's always, you know, or one of those balls with all the lights on it, disco. There's always something you can see. But as far as reading, I would suggest it'll work for me. Mm-hmm. Just don't read anything. You know, and or read mysteries, or if you have to read poetry, you know, there are a lot of great Zen poets and a lot of great poetry, or, you know, or read history, or, but, you know, archaeology, but maybe not Buddhism. So.
May I share? So I had a similar type of question for our teacher Angie and in Dokusan, and she also just told me, just sit. Mm-hmm. That's all. And like Carolyn, I did the same thing for about a year and a half. I didn't read one thing pertaining to Buddha at all. I just sat. So when you think you're going to pick up a book, just sit. That's all. And after a while, when you come to sit here or wherever you end up with Sangha and you listen to Dharma talks, that's when you just take it in. You take it in here. Take it in here. You don't take it in here. It's here.
Thank you, Judy.
So this is the first time I'm coming here. Last week we came here with a friend. And I said, well, we missed this lecture, so I started from again. I did a meditation very first time. So my mind is very, so wavering, it's keep changing. So it's very hard for me to keep my mind or my thoughts still. So what I did this time, it was the first time ever I had tried, that I was able to close my eyes and do meditation. So the question I have for you is, what is meditation? Because when you meditate, you close your eyes, your stream of thoughts keep coming. And the thoughts will come which it bothers you, which are you worried about. The way I was processing my thoughts is like, thoughts comes in, because they worry you. So you start solutioning it. You start finding, okay, let's take care of this thought. Then it's done. But the next will come in. So what is meditation like? You ignore the thoughts and you focus on a blank somewhere, which is hard for me. Or you let thought come in, you ignore. Or let thought come in and you solution the thought. So I don't know what is the outcome of meditation. So if we can talk something on that, that will be helpful.
Thank you for the question. The outcome depends on the individual. So it's that's one reason why this, what we were just talking about, just the sitting, it's so simple that it just, if you just do it long enough, you have to persevere. It's not like, it happens, you know, in one sitting, or even could take a while, you know? And there's no way to say how long it will take. But just sitting cuts out, or I like the metaphor that I used from Koban. Thoughts come, you know, they come, and like I'll expand a little bit, they knock at the door. And you acknowledge them and you say, thought, and then sort of putting together all these threads that we've been talking about from Craig, and you say, oh, this is, maybe you could use a phrase like, well, not worth my time, you know, so let that one go. But really, don't invite them in for tea. Don't go down. Another metaphor is, don't get on the thought train. Don't just let it keep going and going and going, you know? So it's not a blank. You're just using another faculty of awareness that we're not used to using. So it takes just sitting down and getting used to the subtleties, which flows through our whole body. So you can feel it anywhere in the body. You can take it in here, or you can feel it. Here is the traditional way it's talked about, taking it in. But actually, we are one unified mind-body system. We're not, you know, just the thoughts. So being, it's like just noticing that there's that possibility. Maybe that will be of help to you. But persevering.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.
It's a big part of it, practicing. And no matter what it is, here's another saying. We're not practicing for perfection. Practice itself is perfect. Just doing this, no matter how many bad thoughts we have, no matter how many thoughts we have, no matter how crazy we think we are, just doing it, that's it. That's doing it. And